Hello, you. Welcome to You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies. Today, we are talking about Logan. We're talking about it with our great friend, Fangirl Jean. I am one of your hosts, Alex Steed, and I will soon be joined by my marvelous co-host, Sarah Marshall. Logan is a 2017 American superhero film starring Hugh Jackman as the titular character. We're going to talk all about Logan in Marvel movies and all that in the episode itself. So I'm not going to get any further into the Wikipedia info. The introductory paragraph for Logan the movie on Wikipedia is like 13 lines long. It's usually like three or four lines. So it's doing a lot of heavy lifting. We will get into it in the episode. If you are a Marvel fan, there's a lot in here for you. If you are not a Marvel fan, there's a lot in here for you. We go deep and broad. We go deep and broad in this episode. Fangirl Jean, who has been on the show a handful of times before, we love Jean so much, is a writer, a media critic, a consultant, and an unapologetic fangirl. We always have fun when Jean is here, and Jean's so kind to us. Jean is a fan, and we aren't necessarily fans, and Jean helps us see the light, as it were. How are you doing? What's going on in your world? How are you feeling? What are you thinking about? What are you reading? What are you watching? What is happening? Let us know. We're at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod, depending on which social media platform we're on, where you post reels over on Instagram. And I do the TikToks over at Alex Steed. And we are on the various platforms. There's so many that it's hard to keep up with all of them, but we're mostly there. So come find us over there. Let us know what is going on in your world. And don't forget that you, my friend, you are good. Thank you so much for being here. You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies, is made possible with and by your support. Thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon and Apple Podcast subscriptions. In exchange for that support, you get bonus episodes. We just put out a bonus episode about Mannequin. We'll have another one out about Mannequin 2 soon. We'll have one out with our great friend, Open Mike Eagle, about The Iron Claw relatively soon. We have a lot going on over in bonus land. So thank you so much for supporting the shows, and hopefully you enjoy those bonus episodes. If you, like me, are an advocate of ceasefire, please look into local actions in and around your neighborhood and area. And if you're looking to contribute materially in some way, if you're able to do so, Palestine Children's Relief Fund is linked in our show notes. Please click on that link. I don't think we have any broad disclaimers for the content of this episode. This movie deals with a lot of themes about fathers. This movie is wall-to-wall fathers. So I don't think we have any real content warnings along those lines. But here's Jean with a broader bit of information and disclaimer about this very episode before we get into it in a bigger way. So here is Jean.
So I just wanted to give a disclaimer that Logan and all of the X-Men characters that were once owned by 20th Century Fox are now the property of Marvel and Disney. And as a fan of Marvel and someone who's given them a lot of free real estate on social media, I feel like that I should acknowledge that the BDS movement has called for a boycott of Captain America 4, which was already under fire because its original title was the name of an infamous anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. But specifically, the boycott is regards to the character of Sabra, a superhero whose name is reminiscent of the Sabra Shatila massacre in Lebanon. And so they're calling for a boycott of the film and associated merchandise, asking for that character to be removed from the movie. So I just wanted to acknowledge that.
All right. With that said, let's get into it. Let's talk about Logan. Let's talk about Professor Xavier. Let's talk about Richard E. Grant. Richard E. Granting all over the place. Let's talk about this other guy's Doc Holliday impression. Let's talk top to bottom daddies with Fangirl Jean. Hello, Sarah Marshall.
Hello, Alex Steed.
Sarah, do you remember when you and I had a show and it was called Why Are Dads?
Yes, this is still that show, really.
This is that show where we're like, let's grow it a little bit. But somehow we never talked about a movie that dedicated every square inch, every character relationship, every possible trauma and avoidance of trauma. We somehow never covered, I feel like, the daddy of them all, Logan.
Yes, or as I keep wanting to call it, Logang.
We've been meaning to do this for, I think, since we were called Why Our Dads. Mm-hmm. We've been meaning to do it with our fabulous friend, Fangirl Jean. And she's been wonderfully patient.
Shouldn't we play theme music when our guests enter, really? I'm going to do the Price is Right theme. Da, 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 da. You remember that?
Yes.
Oh my God. There's a fabulous 20,000 Hertz episode about all of the sound design and development of that theme. I love it.
Speaking of old dads, The Price is Right. Come on down. It was an incredible game because I feel like Jeopardy was aimed at like intellectuals who like sat around learning about geography, and The Price is Right was like, do you know how much detergent costs? And people were like, I do know that. I look at it every week.
Right. And the fantasy is like, by knowing, you can win a new refrigerator. It's so good.
Yeah.
Right. Or furniture.
Or the Showcase Showdown, where two showcases of furniture shoot each other.
Like Shane. Jean, hello. How are you? What's going on? Tell me about your relationship with Logan.
Oh, okay. Well, let's just dig in deep. Hi, Fangirl Jean here. And speaking of dads, pretty much the most pivotal paternal figure in my life was my grandfather, who passed away when I was 7 years old. And interestingly enough, it was after his funeral, when we all went back to my grandparents' house, I snuck into the room where all of the, you know, young boy cousins and my brother were hanging out with my cool uncle, and he was sharing all of his comic books with them. And I, of course, being the tomboy that I was, snuck in and stole a comic and snuck away and read it. And it was Logan One. Oh, wow. And so I met Logan when I lost, you know, my father. Mm. And he kind of, disturbingly enough, when you know more about the character, became a kind of father figure for me. And the fact that so much about the character is like the embodiment of the silent generation World War II veteran that could not talk about his feelings, but he could kill things really well, and that was his love language.
Yeah, this is like a funny, this movie is a dialogue of men telling each other alternately, you should talk more, or it would be great if the people in your around you did not talk.
This movie actually would go really well on a double bill with The Irishman.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Totally. Sarah, we've talked about Marvel movies before, and we've talked about the franchise, probably to some people's annoyance, with some of our outsider takes.
There's no correct way to do anything in this day and age, Alex.
I absolutely agreed. What is your...
Are you wearing a Punisher shirt in trans flag colors, yes, by the way?
Oh my God, that is so awesome.
That is the correct way to do something.
Absolutely.
But
it says Frank Castle loves his transgender girlfriend.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
What is your relationship with, do you have any relationship with like the X-Men and Logan and Wolverine?
Well, I guess, you know, so my dad, in a way that allowed him to claim to be represented by more performers mainly, was a child in New Zealand and like a young adult in Australia. And so in the 90s, it still felt exciting for Australians to be famous. As you'll recall, in America, we were like, they're Australian. And so Hugh Jackman was very exciting because when they were doing the big first X-Men movie, I knew it was like a very exciting time for X people. And also it was like, Hugh Jackman, he's Australian. And he is. So I care about that. And
a very common entry to, yeah.
But I also was watching it and thinking about like my feeling fundamentally that like Hugh Jackman is Wolverine and that Patrick Stewart is Professor Xavier because they've been that since I was premenstrual. Mm-hmm. And I'm now an old crone. And so, like, you know, this in a way is like the part of the franchise that cuts the deepest, or the fandom or whatever makes the most sense to call it. And I don't know. I have sort of vaguely positive feelings toward the X-Men because, you know, there's so many of them and they're mutants and that's really fun. And they're kind of like teenagers. They're always dating each other explosively.
Oh, yeah. Soap opera time.
Yeah.
Right. And trying to figure out what to do with their hormonal powers.
I have no knowledge. I just grew up in the 21st century and Hugh Jackman as Wolverine was always there.
See, and you know, I think it's important for history's sake to speak on the fact of, you know, someone who read the comic books. And so I was one of those people when the movie with Hugh Jackman was coming out, I was in those corners of people who were very upset because, you know, the fan casting at the time, because I don't know the exact height. I want to say it's somewhere between like 4'7" and 5 foot is the canonical height of Logan in the comic books.
Oh, well, that's very different.
Yes, he is a short, stocky, very hairy man in the comic books. And so like the dueling fan casts at the time was Bruce Willis and Danny DeVito, which I thought, Sarah, you would really appreciate.
I do. So which do you support personally?
Of those two, at the time I was like, I guess Bruce Willis could probably do it because he does like the attitude really well. And he looks like he knows his way around a cigar, which is really important for that character too.
That does make sense. It's so hard to do superheroes because you have to cast people who are de facto immortal. And the thing is, famous people sometimes age very quickly.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, this film is a great example of a trend that was happening in comics in the 2000s, where a lot of these Marvel writers and fans were becoming Marvel writers. So they had grown up with these characters and they were kind of reckoning with what that means as these characters like should age and you know, what are the things that they're going to kind of confront. And so in one of those comic runs, Old Man Logan was an inspiration, was at least a springboard for this film. But I was going to say too, like if my dream casting, and I've been preaching this all over for if when they reboot him, is actually Daniel Radcliffe.
Ooh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's perfect.
I can see that.
It's very short, hairy man.
Yeah, I can see it. I mean, this sounds ridiculous, but I can especially see it after the Weird Al movie.
Yes, right? Like he is a fantastic character actor who just happens to be really famous.
Yes. And is willing to be weird, which I like so much about him.
Right.
Before we get into the plot, Gene, there are a couple of things I'd like to cover just to give some background without having to recap every X-Men movie or every whatever.
Kevin Bacon's in one of them.
Yeah, that's my favorite one. So my two questions, and I'm going to frame them up front and then we'll do sort of one at a time, is one, I know comics have always been dealing with themes, right? But like, when was there a movement toward these like, quote, serious stories from going from like, just like serialized stories about sort of X-Men doing their things to like multi-part examinations of like Logan or Wolverine dealing with immortality or stuff like when did that trend start to happen? Because it feels like that's the stuff that started to like get into movies eventually that made like the movies, quote, adult.
Well, for the specific character, I would say like the late 90s was when, you know, kind of the reevaluation was happening. I would say like as comic books, because none of this happens in a vacuum. Like everything that's happening in Marvel is influenced by what was happening with DC and vice versa. And I am by no measure an expert on this. I just know the corner of hyperfixation that I have with comic books and the related media. But I do think that Alan Moore's Watchmen really kind of changed the landscape of what comics could be talking about, especially in reference to the idea of superheroes and what that meant, both as people, human beings, but all and also within the political landscape. And I think that influence kind of carried through. Plus, you know, it was all part of that same feeling in the 90s where, you know, independent film was a big thing. You know, it was a Gen X thing where we all really just wanted to sit around and talk about our lives, even when we worked at convenience stores, and just like, you know, or talk about, you know, Star Wars and talk about these things that we grew up as kids and go, wow, you know, that was really weird or that was not so great. And I think a lot of that indie self-reflection, media about nothing type of mentality kind of leaked its way into comic books, which, you know, media about nothing is absolutely about stuff.
Yeah.
But taking that lens and going inward on these characters that a lot of these creators who are writing the books and people who, you know, reading them and having, you know, a reciprocal relationship with creators were examining, like, what does it mean to be immortal? You know, what does it mean to have been a brainwashed soldier? And also, like, I wanted to point this out because it's obviously a big factor in this story as well, but canonically through the comic books, Logan has always had this very weird, odd, and I say weird, like in quirky, weird, odd couple relationship with a teenage girl. Mm-hmm. Not at all sexual, not even like necessarily paternal, very much of like, odd couple, like we are two people who have to work in this job together and we're kind of annoyed with each other. Or, you know, he's the grumpy and the other one's like, why are you grumpy? You're really annoying because you're grumpy. That mm-hmm. level of like teenage girl who is bugging him. And it's been Kitty Pryde, who is Shadow Cat. It has been Jubilee. And then, of course, in the X-Men films, they paired him up with Rogue. And recently it's been Kamala Khan, Ms. Marvel has been paired up with, and that dynamic of like the stodgy, grumpy old dude, and then the bright, enthusiastic, but also doesn't take shit teenage girl.
Mm-hmm. A classic pairing, like Leon the Professional.
The Punky Brewster.
It's true. Punky Brewster. Little Orphan Annie.
Yes. Oh my God, I did not realize that Punky Brewster is just Little Orphan Annie. I did not realize that until now.
I am so honored that I got to be here for you to realize that.
You told me. I will remember forever that Fangirl Jean made the connection that this is just 80s Annie, outside of Annie, which was also 80s. Right. And then, so knowing that, that's sort of how that came together, the other connective question that I feel like is important for going into this episode is, generally speaking, because I feel like we're going to cover a lot of ground here on this, like, what is Logan's relationship with Charles Xavier?
Let's even back up a little bit more. What is an X-Man?
So an X...
I love it. That's great.
X-Man is... the X-Men are a group of mutants, which are human beings, or, you know, you could argue about species, but people who are born with mutations that can be read as superpowers, can be read as visible differences or disabilities within the context of the comic books. Well, in the movies, they're always seen as like superhuman powers of some kind. But the team itself was formed by Charles Xavier, who is a wealthy daddy warbucks.
Wow.
Who decided to adopt these, you know, teens, these superpowered teens.
I like how all their parents were like, sure, you can have them.
Well, and here's like where the queer allegory leaks in is that some of these kids were abandoned by their parents because of their differences, which the X-Men movies really make more textual than subtextual. But yeah, so, and turns them into superheroes to give back and to show that mutants, you know, can be a boon to society rather than a threat to society. And that is like the most concise way I can explain that.
That is great.
As far as Charles and Logan's relationship, much like any mythology, it depends on which era you're talking about and which storyline. I think in our contemporary era, they definitely have kind of like a somewhere between like peer and competitor. They have a conflicting kind of relationship, basically like, you know, dual leadership, like old guard, new guard kind of thing.
You can see how Professor X is like at the first wave of mutant civil rights, because his whole argument is about how mutants can be useful to non-mutants. It feels very like Mattachine society.
Yes. Well, and you can see that like that is definitely somebody who grew up wealthy in Westchester, and that would be his approach. And that you can see that they're like two dueling perspectives on the experiences that they've had. Mm-hmm. I always like to think of Logan as kind of a middle ground between Magneto, who is more of a, I would say, political radical mutant that not only doesn't believe in kowtowing to humans, but absolutely believes in having a whole separate he's a segregationist, essentially. He wants mutants to have their own space.
He's the Marcus Garvey of the X-Men
right.
universe. Which is crazy. I feel like we're answering the why are comic books important question.
Right? Well, we get to test out these perspectives within a safe fictional realm.
And it's interesting because it's like all, I mean, it's like literally mythology. Like that's what it's drawing from, like the going, you know, especially with Marvel, like just pulling from Thor. It's like, it's mythology, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have this interesting thing where you then get to play with the mode and style of mythology. So like, this is like, you take that larger mythology and then make it a future Western.
Right.
And it's like so fucking cool. Like you can do that. Cause like there are some of these, I'm not going to call them outlying because I don't want to disrespect people's love for the Marvel universe. I get it. I absolutely get it. Or in Sony, I understand that sort of like the whole thing or whatever, but like some of these movies I don't care about. Mm-hmm. A lot of the movies I actually don't very care about.
Well, look, I mean, to use the parlance of probably yesterday, stop standing for corporations. They won't fuck you.
Yeah. Right. Thank you. Precise. But there are some that by taking sort of like the macro stuff that we're dealing with here and then using interesting sort of delivery styles or remixing existing delivery styles that we know, they just like satisfy the fuck out of me. And this is one of the ones that does that the most.
You know what I would say is maybe this is a useful allegory, maybe it's not, but you know, that's what's great about working in a medium where if you say something stupid, an editor cuts it out and nobody hears it, and then people think you're smarter than you are.
We are blessed.
Because you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, and a lot of the shots are bad. But what if a Marvel movie, broadly speaking, is metaphorically a hamburger, right? People like hamburgers, and it's because they have ingredients that we like. We like action. We like things that follow a formula, but not too much. Mm-hmm. And where we get to be a little bit surprised, and it's part of a bigger story, but we don't have to like get too immersed in thinking about it, ideally, and whatever. But like, we like action. We like feelings. We like music. We like explosions, obviously, colors. I like colors, very important to me. And so you can see every Marvel movie as a hamburger. And you would think that that would be foolproof. And yet some of them are bad. Some people got overwhelmed. They had to order the meat. Then it arrived. They didn't have a refrigerator, you know?
They're like, you want two fried eggs? We'll put two fried eggs on it. It's cool. Whatever. Whatever you want. You want Gouda? Whatever.
And you're like, I don't want that. And they're like, no. That's the special. And sometimes it's just like kind of unimaginative, but you're still like, it's like when you're on Amtrak, you're like, this is still technically a cheeseburger. I'm not unhappy about it. And sometimes it's like amazing. But the fundamentals are the same.
That's so good. The fucking Amtrak cheeseburger.
I love an Amtrak cheeseburger. I love a Quick Trip cheeseburger. I love a cheeseburger that's been sitting under a light bulb. You know, even when they're bad, they're good. Unless you get, you know, some horrible disease.
Right. It's about expectations. And I mean, what you just described, that's comic books too, you know?
Yeah. And it's romance novels and
right,
horror
exactly.
movies. Yeah.
And one of the things I like about, especially like superheroes as a genre of media, is that, like I've said before many times, it is contemporary modern mythology. And much in the way it's helped me understand ancient mythology a little bit better, especially like Greek mythology, because if you look at it rather than like, these are the gods and this is how they made our world, it's more of like, this is people with a lot of power and this is why our world's the way it is. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I think on a fantastical scale, so much of the dynamics that are being explored in the comic books, while they're also in the movies, while they're punching and time traveling and all these things, they're all just kind of us exploring why our world's the way it is and how that's rooted to why we are the way we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
One of the things I love about sci-fi fantasy genre is that it can make subtext into literal text, where you can literally be having a fight with yourself, where you can literally have your past history mistakes come back and kick the shit out of you.
Yeah, so good.
We love that trick. I love it.
Right.
Well, before we go for, because we're going to keep going in this direction, and Gene, thank you so much for helping set the, you know, I know that like not everyone who listens to the show like has this background, so I'm really glad that we were able to do that with you. But before we go further, Sarah, are you in a position to help us walk through the plot of this movie?
I mean, in a general kind of way, but let's be honest, I don't understand a lot of what's happening here.
Yeah, yeah, we're happy to help.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, Alex, so you love this movie. Do you want to take it for a spin?
I do love this. I'm gonna try.
You know what? I know Stephen Merchant is in this.
If Stephen Merchant is in this, I'm gonna try my hardest. I did realize that this is a movie that I enjoy very much. In rewatching it, I was like, oh, a whole bunch of stuff happens that I don't remember. And I really have to get my brain checked out because I don't know why I couldn't remember the things. So, okay. So here's what happens. We open in, I for some reason, I remember this movie being way later in the future, but we open 5 years from now.
It used to be later in the future when you first saw this.
In 2029, we open with Logan, who is a limo driver, I believe.
Yeah.
He's a driver for hire.
He's essentially like a Lyft driver.
Yeah, he's a driver for hire.
He's got prom kids in his limo at one point, which is a fantastic inclusion. It's a little bit No Country for Old Men coded even.
Yes.
Yes.
No, totally. Totally. There are a handful of guys who are trying to, I think, steal his tires. You know, he's older than we remember. His beard is scraggly and gray, or it's starting to gray. Up to this point, we know him as kind of being indefinitely immortal, which I guess those indefinite suggest immortality. And we get a fabulous fight in which he is mostly the Logan and Wolverine that we know, but his claws aren't coming out all the way. He's losing his virility. There's a lot of imagery happening there with him not being able to get one of his claws hard, and he kills these guys in an extremely satisfying and brutal way. This movie is so violent.
It really is.
This movie's about a little girl and it's so violent.
So much of the fight choreography is amazing, but the beginning of that fight, he is more concerned about them not damaging the car. Yeah. That he is like, right, diving in front of bullets and like dabbing guys to keep them from hitting the car with a crowbar. Also, you could tell that somebody involved in this project really wanted to see over and over what happens when the claws go through someone's face.
As did I, for that matter. Right. Yeah, he's well, and I love that he's a victim of the gig economy.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right, because he's like, if you fuck up the car, I can't make money.
Right.
We learn that he's ultimately trying to make enough money through all of these drives to buy a boat so that he can get Charles Xavier. And he says that he's going to help Caliban, but like Caliban knows that he's not going to help him to whatever kind of safety. They're going to go out and live on the water.
That's the story he's telling.
Oh, he's going to do a Godfather part two.
Yeah, because really, like, I read it as the reason to have the boat was to get Charles away from any people. Mm-hmm. And then to kill himself.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, because he has the bullet. Yes. So Charles, they're living in El Paso. They're living in like an abandoned smelting mine.
Actually, they're not. He's working out of El Paso. They're living in Mexico.
Oh,
this is very timely because he is working in America and then commuting to Mexico to live because it's cheaper there.
And nobody thinks of Wolverine when they create these policies, right? You know?
No one's thinking of a Wolverine. That is the truth. And so they're living there. Charles is in a smelting tank so that his brain doesn't hurt people. So we learn over time that there was an incident in which Charles, who is either suffering from dementia or something is happening where he's losing his control capacity over his very powerful brain.
Just like Brian Cox in Succession.
Exactly. And that's exactly right. And he killed hundreds of people accidentally with his powerful brain.
Yeah, I read that what's happening, whatever the cause is that those moments are Charles having a seizure. And this is what happens when the most powerful psychic in the world has a seizure. Everybody within a certain distance radius of him has the seizure too.
And we see really, we get a taste of that a handful of times in the movie in a really great and kind of interesting and plot pointy action-y way. So Logan is approached by Gabriella. Where does she work and what's the significance of this place, Jean?
She's a nurse that worked at a facility that was, you know, a technology company that develops weapons, because of course they do. And that was experimenting, not necessarily experimenting on children, but was basically, you know, making designer mutant babies.
Yeah, fantastic. And just so we're, just to cover some ground on the front end of this, Logan's with his dad. The bad doctor's dad created Logan. And then there's a nice rancher dad. And there's so many dads, and we're going to spend some time with all of them. And that guy's played by Eric Lissalle. Yeah. Which is amazing.
Was he in ER?
He was, yeah.
Oh my God.
So he's approached by Gabriella, who is trying to get this little girl who he learns name is Laura. We also know that Charles has been saying, and we don't know if it's part of his brain slippage or what's going on, but we learn that Charles has been in communication with a mutant. Logan doesn't believe that it's true because no one believes that there are mutants, whatever. He's approached by Gabriella. Gabriella is very nervous and paranoid because she's being chased by the bad men. We've met one of these bad men who introduces himself. I don't know if this guy, what is the guy's name who has the hand who we see throughout the movie?
Oh my God, I always forget his name because he is just a dude.
Some guy.
Holbrook, that's his last name.
I don't know if that's a real Southern accent, and if it is, it's bad.
Right.
And he is so campy. He introduces himself to Logan as I live and breathe the Wolverine, and I love this guy so much because he's kind of bad.
Right, like, I feel like this is a young guy who grew up watching Tombstone.
Sure.
And was doing his version of, you know, I'm your Huckleberry.
Absolutely, he's doing his best Val.
That is the accent that he's trying to do.
Doc Holliday robot hand man.
Exactly.
That's so good. Yeah, Doc. This guy's name is Doc from now on.
Okay.
So he, representing the Transigen team, is looking for this little girl, is going after Gabriella. Gabriella is trying to get the little girl off to the safe space. It's somewhere north. It's across the border. And this is where the plot starts to really feel like Children of Men. Mm-hmm. And we don't know if it's real or not. And she approaches Logan and is like, I will give you conveniently the exact amount of money you need to buy the boat, because we know he has $45,000. We know the boat's $97,000. She's going to give him $50,000.
It's a classic Mad Max type situation.
Yeah,
it's perfect. She's going to give him the amount of money to drive them north, because that's the only thing that moves him at this point, because his whatever humanity he had before has been sucked out of having been alive for so long. And he agrees to take them. He goes to get Laura. This girl's adorable. Like, her portrayal of this character is so great. I love it so much because she's like at once adorable and looks like she could murder you. And that's one of my favorite combinations in a child.
The most realistic depiction of a child at that age, right? Like, you can see she's about to enter middle school and she's about to destroy every adult that comes into contact with her.
Good for her.
Yeah, right.
And so he goes to pick them up. Gabrielle has been murdered. He goes back, realizes that there's danger that's going to come to Charles and Caliban. He goes back to the ranch, as it were. He collects them, and suddenly the Transigen team, backed by some authorities, they're coming with their cavalry, and then he is able to collect Charles and the girl to leave. The cavalry takes Caliban, who is a tracker. What's he say? He's a glorified truffle pig or something?
Yes. That's Caliban's mutant power amongst, you know, the other visible differences and stuff with him. He's able to sniff out literally other mutants.
And now we're off to the races.
Yeah, I was going to point out that those aren't any kind of official soldiers. Those are all mercenaries. And I think it's really interesting how much capitalism plays a part in the story in a very like underlying way of like how much all of this is about money and making people into products.
Right. And yes, because we get like, we do get backstory from, fortunately, Gabriella has recorded some video about what is going on. And whatever this corporation is doing was trying to develop these children as weapons. We're very familiar from how Logan himself was developed into a killing machine, trying to develop weapons. They realize that the problem with humans is that there's always some tapping into conscience, which makes them being killing machines difficult. And so they finally realize that they could just develop what we get of this later reminds of whatever Terminator sequel it is where like old Terminator has to fight young Terminator.
Yes.
The corporation realizes that they can make essentially a clone of Wolverine sans soul, and they've wasted all this time on these children, so they just start killing the children. Gabriella has taken some of the children, they've gotten free. And Gabriella some of the children have been liberated. They've gone north, and Gabriella has taken Laura, who she loves, who is not her daughter, but she loves her as a parental figure. And we learn over time, as does Logan, it takes him a very long time to accept it, which is an extremely dad situation, that this is essentially his daughter. It's his daughter through cloning. And in that scene where Transigen and the mercenaries approach, we see her kind of shine for the first time and like in killing these mercenaries, which includes decapitating a mercenary and then throwing his head at everybody, which again, real Logan move.
As someone who read that comic at age 7, I have been waiting my entire life for that scene because there are kids, you know, that were like, I want to be the dangerous killing machine too. I want to see a group of armed men be really afraid of me.
How did it feel? Were you happy with it?
Yes, I was nervous at first because the character was not that young in the comic books, because she did exist in the comics. But then when I saw the first trailer that had that, you know, clips from that scene, I was like, oh, they're going there. Like being able to see a young girl kind of inhabit that space. One of the things I loved that I don't talk about much about the movie is that at no point anywhere in the film is she ever sexualized, which should not be something that I have to call out, but absolutely is.
But we grew up on The Professional.
Right?
Again.
Right? Like that she could occupy this very masculine space, especially with the violence, and still be treated like a child, but not in a condescending way.
Right, because a thing that we get over time with the movie that I think she needs to be this young in order for what some of the movie is doing is we have all of the adults in her life are people, including Charles, which we'll talk about later, but all of the adults in her life are people who have blood on their hands and are trying to figure out how to deal with it, and they can't. And Logan even says at some point, she's like, I've killed people. And he's like, yeah. And she was like, they were bad people. And he's like, it's all the same. And she gets a film lesson about Shane from Charles, which, you know, conveniently are watching the part about reconciling being a good or a bad person. And so this is a child who, rather than dealing with this stuff in retrospect, she's still gonna have to deal with it, is like figuring out like how she is going to wield her power moving forward rather than having regrets about it necessarily in the past.
Yeah, and I want to compliment the movie because there isn't like a wasted second in this film. Everything that happens is propelling the story forward, either through actions of what they're doing or through the character development themselves. And like, it's established in the nurse's little film thing that she makes for Logan that these kids have never seen the outside world. And so everything that Laura does going forward is something that she's either seen or seen in the film Shane. You know, even like the funeral stuff, that's something she saw through that. And so you see how she's like absorbing and gathering. I love filmmaking like that where you can go back and be like, oh yeah, she got that from there. Oh, okay. Right. Okay.
Totally. Well, and the thing about James Mangold too, who I love, like what is important, I think, to note, people may remember that 2007 was a real golden year for Western revival movies.
Yes, it really was.
It was No Country for Old Men, 310 to Yuma, which James Mangold directed, and There Will Be Blood.
Yeah, True Grit also not
True
long
Grit,
after
thank you.
That, and The Hurt Locker, which is, you know, very much a Western.
Yeah.
Well, like, yeah, and I felt like they're not just Westerns, but they're like, well, mostly male filmmakers kind of in conversation with the Westerns that they grew up with.
Yeah.
Totally. And they're like, there's only one Unforgiven. Like, there should be more. And they just all made their version of that. and we thank them. And that you feel that DNA in this movie in a big way, in that this movie is in conversation with the role of the Western and masculinity, in like actual conversation within the movie.
Yeah. And since you brought up Westerns and masculinity, I wanted to just make a point, because I think it's really demonstrated in this, is that I've always viewed Westerns, especially as they exist in the canon of America, as a discussion that we have about the trauma of being a war veteran.
Right.
I mean, even within the genre itself, like what it's depicting is post-Civil War. But each time you see these revivals happen, we're having kind of a cultural conversation of post-Vietnam, post the Iraq War.
Right. Those were all Iraq movies.
Having a moment to really talk about, in not direct ways, of course, because we can't actually talk about our feelings, but we're talking about the trauma of not just experiencing violence, but the trauma of being the one inflicting violence, which I think is a big undercurrent of Logan's character that I think Marvel tries, like, people are trying to have this conversation. I've talked about it before when I talk about Bucky, the Winter Soldier, is, you know, a big symbol of the trauma of being a weapon of war, that is about what we do to soldiers and how we dehumanize our soldiers. Again, like, I feel, I don't know if it's intentional, just like with Westerns, I don't know if that's intentionally what a lot of these creators are doing, but that's how I read so much of it, is that these are conversations that men are having with themselves about, like, you know, I killed them, they're bad guys, but no, they're all the same.
Right.
Like, so what does that say about me? And do I become a weapon? And how can I become a person after I've been a weapon?
Yeah. So we're on the road. We stop in Vegas. The Antigen team and the militia close in.
For a second, I thought there was a hot villainess character named Militia.
We stop in Vegas. They close in on our on Logan, Charles, and Laura. And Charles has one of the, either forcibly has this, I don't understand. Maybe he is having a seizure to stop them closing in.
Yeah, that's what he says later, that he did that to help. But, you know, again, it's like one of the things I really like about Charles' character in this is that it is the most, again, like a super realistic depiction of what it's like to deal with somebody who has, you know, a mental illness of some kind that affects their behavior and stuff, where you're not sure, like, they may be like, no, I totally did that on purpose, fuck you. And then you're like, well, maybe, I don't know.
And that's a thing I haven't really talked much about in the plot, is the dynamic is that because he had this situation against his will where a bunch of people died, they're essentially just like sedating him all the time so that he's not a danger. And anytime he becomes coherent, he realizes what's happening and is combative with his caregivers, which is a really interesting dynamic. And right out the gate, he tells Logan he's disappointed in him. Like, that's his first line to Logan, is he's like, I'm disappointed in what you've become. And like, great, cool. So like, part of the journey is getting back in Charles's good graces accidentally. And Charles, the entire time that they have the initial run-in back at the ranch, is Logan's trying to get them out of there as quickly as possible, and Charles saying, you have to get the girl, you have to get the girl. And that the resistance between them is like, Logan does not yet care about this girl. And Charles, as a family man who's run sort of a makeshift family for, you know, 70 or 80 years, is hellbent on seeing her as like the future of them.
Well, and that is a literal interpretation of his character conflict, of that he's holding on to the past so hard that he hasn't been able to embrace the future.
So we back on the road.
It's a great American road trip.
Family road trip for sure. Yeah.
Like Little Miss Sunshine.
They are back on the road. They find a family on the side of the road who their horses have gotten out of their trailers, something along those lines.
Yes, because they almost get run off the road by the automated trucks that are speeding along the freeway. Again, like, capitalism tries to kill them, you know. Yeah.
The Nicholas, if you will.
Right. Yes. And later we'll find that their lives are being made hell by the corn syrup production people and machines, which is very true to life in American farmer situation. And they help them out. The family takes them in for a nice dinner. They have a lovely family time together. It's a mom, a dad, and a son. And you're like, there's no possible way this is going to end okay for anybody.
It never does.
The farmer played by Eric LaSalle, they have some water interruption. They have to go down and sort of check out what's happening.
Julianne Moore has got a ping pong ball in her mouth.
You're like, this is not going to end well. There's been interference with sort of the water. Who is interfering with the water?
So essentially, he had an agreement with the neighboring farm that they were sharing the water supply, but then a corporation bought out the neighboring farm and are trying to claim that they own the water supply, and they're cutting off his water. And I like the fact that, like, in that family dinner, we find out that the wife has kind of been trying to get the husband to just give up on the farm and go try something else. Mm-hmm. And like the son's going to, you know, go off to college, and the dad's like, you know, no, we're going to make this work, you know? So again, we have a father figure who's holding on to the past and the consequences of that.
Well, and interestingly, we get these like little, through these interactions with the family are really great. Like, he's essentially explaining to Logan, who has never read anything ever, that corn syrup is in everything, specifically all sorts of drinks that like get you high or pick you up or like, or give you energy or whatever. And he's like, there was a time when a bad day was just a bad day. And that's like, that's kind of great, because like the commentary is all of this inconvenience is happening in order to give us these like small sold to us ties that separate us from actually feeling our feelings, which I think is a really tremendous bit of commentary. And again, earlier Caliban says to Logan, in a really sweet scene, like Caliban's like a very interesting character that we don't get a lot of, but the things that we do get from him are really interesting and revealing, is we learn that Logan had approached Caliban a year ago to help with Charles. And apparently they were on sort of better terms at that point. And Caliban says to Logan, who he realizes is like suicidal, not doing great, realizes his plan is probably to carry through with taking his own life, et cetera. And Caliban says like, look, I can't help you if you don't talk to me. And it's like the most kind of vulnerable male to male exchange that happens. And Logan is not ready for it. And so we get the converse of this scene with this dad, who is just saying sometimes a bad day is just a bad day, who, under the impression that Laura is mute, is like, you know, sometimes I wish that my kid was mute. So he, you know, Logan helps scare away these people who are representing the corporation. They go back to the house, and right after Charles, in just the saddest, sweetest time in his bed, is like, this is the nicest day I've had in a long time, and I don't deserve it because I just remembered that like my outburst a year ago killed 600 people. And that's kind of when we're learning it at the same time. He believes he is talking to Logan. He is not, in fact, talking to Logan. He's talking to the corporate Logan clone killing machine who is standing there above the bed, and that guy just unceremoniously kills Charles. Charles mm-hmm. is dead. He goes through the rest of the house, kills the family. Laura gets out. There's a confrontation between the representatives of the corporation and clone Logan. And one of the representatives of the corporation who we've met throughout this is Richard E. Grant. Just fucking Richard E. Granting all over the place.
Such a joy. LA Stories, Richard E. Grant. Right?
Being Richard E. Grant.
Like, why not?
And again, through exposition, we learn that his dad oversaw the Weapon X project. He is literally overseeing the next generation of the Weapon X project.
That's the kind of business you pass down to your eldest mm-hmm. son, right?
Exactly. We get a fight between Logan and his clone self. He prevails momentarily and leaves with the girl. Caliban sacrifices himself in order to sort of do some damage to the team by blowing himself up in a truck. Richard E. Grant, who has developed all of the dad stuff and the parent stuff with him and this clone, is really fascinating because he didn't care about all those other kids. He disregarded all those other kids, but now he has this clone who he refers to as a newborn and like nurtures him back to health so that he can be a perfect rageful killing machine.
I mean, as I've said before, these things aren't really subtle.
I don't love all of my feeling children. We're going to put them all down. But this perfect killing machine who we've manufactured synthetic rage within, he cradles and refers to as a newborn. And it's great. Great themes.
Dr. Generational Trauma cuddles up to toxic masculinity and calls him his newborn baby.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's like a political cartoon.
Totally. That girl's grandpa was just murdered. Like, it's all happening. And so now we're in our third act because as you know, in a serious movie, the second act is over when a person you love says, "I had a great day," and then they are murdered. Like, that is the transition.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's great day-itis is what they're dying of. One time I had a great first date. Notice I say one time. And at the end of it, I was like, well, it's over. There's a killer in that alley.
It's such a trope, though, to the point that I'm like thinking around, like, for the longest time, it was really difficult for me to consume media that was like genuinely hopeful and happy, because I was just so used to like everything's going perfectly. Who's gonna die next?
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah, you're watching the end of Bridget Jones's Diary waiting for somebody to, you know, get crushed by an anvil,
right?
I do like the line. This is just going back to nothing at this point, but I do like the line that Charles delivers to Logan at some point, which is, "I don't think Laura needs reminding of life's impermanence," which mm-hmm. I think is like significant because it's like perfect to be, and I've been this and I still need to fight being this, believing I have it worse than everybody and then carrying around like I do. And then you have to remember that like everyone has it just as bad and like they don't need, you know, like, mm-hmm. and that's what Wolverine is stuck in, is like being so myopic about his experience, not remembering that everyone that this child loves has been murdered because he can't see her as a human being yet.
Mm. One of the things I thought about in this latest rewatch of the million times I've watched this was thinking about how he says at one point that Charles gave him a family. And I read Charles, when he's talking about how he killed those people, he didn't just kill a bunch of civilians, he killed the family. And I think a lot about how Logan and the way that he functions with pain, like the way that we're like, I have it worse than everybody else, is a product of being forced to self-soothe and to deal with your own pain without a support network and without a family. Mm-hmm. And that like a lot of what is happening in this film is teaching us like how that lone paternal masculinity, it isn't able to heal itself ever because it's cutting itself off. And that Laura being returned to her own little X-Men family is also like Logan doing that healing of being able to get to a point of, I can't do this on my own.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, and so, that's a beautiful lead into the third act where, long story short, Logan buries Charles, buries his dad, and buries Laura's new grandpa, and they end up with all of the children who escaped in a real Red Dawn situation. All these kids are just like living out in the woods like revolutionaries.
Also very Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
Yes.
Yes. Especially the scene in which the giggly scissors where he's sleeping and the children cut his hair and his beard to his old school Logan look.
I love it.
The Wonka.
I love that little anemic lizard boy. That's my favorite one.
Yes.
And, you know, he's like, I got you here. Isn't that enough? She throws a tantrum. Not a tantrum. She doesn't throw any tantrum. She's the opposite of me. She goes inside when she's shutting down and broods around. They have this exchange where he's like, everyone who I care about gets hurt, as has just been evidenced by Charles dying. And she's like, good, I don't have to worry about anything then, which, you know, suggests that she realizes that she feels unloved by this person who is her dad. And he's in on his last legs. He's really been through it. There's a final fight with all the corporate bad guys. We can talk about the subtext of that in a second. And decides finally to show up for his daughter, help get her to the finish line, realize that like just because he's been hurt doesn't mean that he can't show up for other people. Mm-hmm. Very important lesson for everybody who watches it, including myself. And he helps her and the kids cross over to where they're ultimately trying to go. And he dies in the process. Like, he gives his life doing mm-hmm. it. There's a very beautiful scene where this kid clearly with a photographic memory delivers a small monologue from Shane in tribute to him and in tribute to like what she now has to deal with. They have a conversation along the way again about her starting to acknowledge the burden of killing, and he has a, he has a lot of thoughts and feelings about that because that's defined his life. And then just like a small aside that I only noticed this time in the movie is we learn that the reason there haven't been mutants born in 20 to 25 years is there's been an intentional intervention with genetically modified something by this company that's gone into the food supply.
Yeah, this is a little bit too much fodder for TikTok conspiracy theories, I think.
Yeah. Well, and it's good, whatever. Like, I don't think it was so unnecessary. I've seen this movie like 5 times, and this is the first time I was like, oh, they're talking about something about food supply stuff. But it's interesting because it at least talks about like the power and reach of that sort of food thing. But it didn't really do a whole lot for me, but I guess we can talk about that themes wise. And then that's it.
He dies saying, I guess this is what this feels like.
Yes, because he never thought that that was so. So it's a twofold thing. Well, what is your read on that? I don't want to step on it.
My read was that's him experiencing death.
So I think it works on two levels at once. I think it's that, and I think it's also him feeling love, like him actually showing up, and he's like, this is what it feels like. And then in a classic fear of men, what happened is the fear played out, which is like, if I show up, I'm gonna die.
Well, and this is where I want to talk about the trope of the seasoned warrior with the young precocious girl, which has raised in popularity again in media. We've seen it, you know, with Arya Stark in Game of Thrones, with the Hound, and then obviously new with The Last of Us. And this is one of the few times where you have men paired with a woman or a girl where it's not at all sexualized. And I've always seen this as a way for men and male creators to care for their younger selves in a way that doesn't trigger masculine fears. So like the reason that so often we see in media when men are interacting with boys, there's a very specific masculine dynamic that has to be at play. And I always read that. And this is, again, this is somebody who was assigned female at birth, so definitely correct me if I'm wrong, but that there is a trigger of fear for men when it comes to looking at boys and boyhood and childhood, because there is that fear of that vulnerability, of that, like, you want to make him strong, you want to make him powerful, you want to make sure he's okay and that he can make it on his own, right? And that in these dynamics with these young girls, they're allowed to be emotionally vulnerable, they're allowed to have these deeper connections with girls because they're not boys. And in this way, it is much more about an adult man experiencing caring for his vulnerable younger self in a safe way.
Yeah, well, I've talked about this on the show before, where I have younger male friends and I have had times where it's like I've just been mean to them. Like, I'd been mean to them out of care. Like, I'm looking out for you, you know? And then I eventually realized, I was like, oh, I'm being mean to my younger self. Like, I'm not, this is not about you. This is about nothing you've done. Just something about you is reminding me of vulnerable little me. And I think that by like hazing you or being like tough or whatever, I'm getting you ready for something, and it has nothing to do with you. It's all me.
But it's a fear too. Like, this is a complicated conversation that you have with parents whose children have just come out as queer, of like that fear that you're experiencing is not their responsibility. Mm. It is you re-experiencing the vulnerability of childhood in a new context because you didn't think you had to worry about that with them.
Right.
And, you know, so like that, I'm going to toughen him up is coming from a place of like, I can't protect him. There is not a way to be able to protect him. And you see that in the use of this trope is the man, like, he's fearing the relationship because it makes him vulnerable. And that is also triggering his inability to protect the child that he was and to be able to kind of confront that.
Yes.
And, you know, and so I see this, I'm not saying that it's not a paternal relationship, but I do think, especially as someone who's assigned at female birth, who grew up through the 80s and, you know, 90s, and with this type of dynamic being reoccurring again and again, and it's shaping so many women who consumed this media and our relationship with ourselves, our gender, and then with men in our lives, I do think think that it's interesting to kind of look at how this inability to communicate emotions and feelings and how what young girls represent and how we change, mm-hmm. but what we represent as we mature and go into puberty and how, like, you know, like I thought about this today when I was looking at watching the Brooke Shields documentary and thinking about how when I grew up, like Brooke Shields and Blue Lagoon and Jodie Foster and Taxi Driver, and like thinking about how young girls were very sexualized when I was, you know, I was about that age and it was just like a normal thing. And then how that shifted and changed, but very conditionally based on whether that girl performed a certain type of masculinity that was very much coded as a young boy and how I found safety in performing that type of masculinity as being the tomboy.
Yeah. And that it was, you know, so uncontroversial. I mean, it was, I'm sure it was controversial on many fronts, but that it was still just like a way of selling jeans.
Totally.
It's like, you want to sell jeans? I'll tell you what to do. Don't make good jeans. That would be crazy.
Right. And that there was a spinoff magazine from Playboy called, I think, Sugar and Spice, that was the magazine that featured Brooke Shields full frontal.
You should see Sarah's in my faces right now.
Right. These things existed, and that it was so like normalized, and that, well, of course she's a beautiful girl. And like, for me, it's going, what changed? What shifted? You know, why did we think that this girl at this age was not a sexual object, but a girl who is probably the same age, she is a sexual object? And why, you know, as a culture, how did that point of view change and shift?
There's a great, as part of I think it's like 30 parts. So I hate suggesting any media to anyone that is more than an hour, but erotic 80s and 90s from You Must Remember This covers a lot of the casting of girls, particularly by like quote auteurs, and the excuses that it's art, and the excuses that we're doing something like psychologically subversive, and we're talking about sort of like repression and sexuality sort of like in mass media for the first real time. And so that leaves a lot of opportunity to like essentially pull one over on everybody, for lack of a better.
Right. Like, as a 48-year-old on TikTok, and to see the wave again and again of like where this precious new generation of adults are like, David Bowie slept with a 13-year-old, or this actor, you know, Rob Lowe was in a sex tape with a 16-year-old. Like, and I'm like, oh, wow, they don't know this. They don't know that. And they're like, where were the parents? And I was like, guys, like, this was just nowhere. They were nowhere, or they didn't care. Drew Barrymore was at Studio 54 doing cocaine and drinking.
There's pictures of her as like an 8-year-old with like a pack of cigarettes. And you're like, it's fucking unreal.
And she's my age. I was lucky that I didn't see those pictures until the first time she went into rehab. So I was a teenager at that point and was going, holy crap, that was all going behind the scenes when she was in ET.
It's wild.
Right?
Yeah. And I think we have this shift that comes with all of the issues with sort of corporate ownership and who owns what or whatever. But like, even the more like democratization of like mass media, where people get to like tell their actual stories, not the story that was like told in their behalf. The thing with like being a kid when we were kids, and I think there's good and bad stuff about this, it took a long time to have the ability to talk to more than three people about anything and have them listen.
Yes.
Right. And by the time that maybe you built the ability to do that, you'd already internalized some of the biases of the system. Mm-hmm. And so it takes you a handful of years to get like any sort of power. And then by that point that you do have like a people's ear, the way things used to work, you have already internalized some of the biases of the system and accepted them. And like, now kids, the good thing is they can call bullshit before accepting the biases of the system. And that is great. And so that sparks conversations earlier, and that's fantastic. I'm not going to say bad, because I don't necessarily think that that's the case, but like, I'm so glad a lot of the first thoughts that I had weren't first thought, best thought, and I didn't have an audience to announce them to. Mm-hmm. I was just working stuff out.
And you had to handwrite your thoughts or type them and then, you know, photocopy them.
Right. And I didn't want to be held accountable by, you know, potentially 1 million to 10 million people who come upon the thing that I see. So there's an interesting shift there.
Well, and my counterpoint to that is that if we had had that technology, we would also have the benefits of that technology as well.
Sure.
It would have been game changing for me in 1992 to be able to have access to a large community of queer people.
Totally.
From being in a tiny town in Alaska with literally only like four other openly queer kids in my high school, it would have been game changing. And so, yeah, I probably would have, you know, no, I did make a lot of mistakes and absolutely embarrassed myself a lot. You know, I did have a stage because I was a theater kid too. So I got that humiliation in before the internet was a really big thing. But also those resources are there. And so like for me, I think about like part of how we end up getting to this jaded state is that for our reality, we couldn't do these things. So it's really difficult for us to imagine that kids coming along now could, you know, like we've been beaten down over and over again. So that reality, a reality is shaped by that, and that it's difficult to have these moments of like, oh, wait a minute. Like this is part of the reason I got into TikTok was being able to like heal something in myself to see so many young kids who are queer, who are open, to see like happy lesbians in their early 20s. Like that's a thing. Like, I don't know if I follow the account, but I saw one where it was three generations of lesbians in a family. So it was like the grandmothers and then their daughters and then their daughters and them getting to like tell stories of what it was like when they were, you know, first coming out and when they met, and then like seeing these different strides that are made by the, you know, different generations. And that is, you know, to bring it all back to Logan, I think that that is a thing that we do lose touch when we've been beaten down so much. Like you said, that like, it's so difficult. We're like, you know, we have it so hard, we can't see our way out of it. And we don't want to try to deal with somebody else's garbage. But at the same time, we don't realize that sharing that with someone else is sharing the burden, and that the more you make community, the lighter the load becomes. And that also that there is a relief in knowing that you're not doing this alone. And that part of that process of community that is always kind of butting up against the way that superhero narratives want to really peddle the singular leader, lone wolf, only one person can, you know, take power and experience change, that actually we prosper when we prosper together, and that the real superhero teams are, you know, and that family dynamic is supposed to function way better than that sole leadership of that one chosen one, one true hero narrative, that it's actually more successful if we form families and communities. And that's the aspect that for me as a kid reading X-Men comic books, it was so revolutionary to me to see like a team of people that were so vastly different. And even at certain points in the eras were led by a Black woman, and that was just a thing. And having grown up as a kid, like the media that I was consuming at a young age were like Good Times. And these were family shows that weren't nuclear family show. I mean, they were, but there was a different culture coming into play with how they weren't just a family, they were a community. And they existed within a context of their neighborhoods. And same thing with like growing up with Sesame Street in the golden years of like, Sesame Street was a way to depict community that we didn't see a lot in mainstream media, that like kids lived in a neighborhood where they knew everybody in their neighborhood, and they were safe going and talking to people in their neighborhood. And that's one of my biggest criticisms to the way that Marvel has been depicting superheroes, is that almost all of them are always just like, this is why they're repetitive. Everybody talks about burnout of the superhero stories and origin stories. And I'm like, there's a reason. Because they're not progressing this idea that if you have people who are othered, people who are different, who are trying to make a space for themselves in a world that's hostile to them, the next progressive step is to create community and to work with others and to use the differences as strengths and to fight for that space. And I think they always get right up there, and then like two white straight guys get in a fight, and then shit's fucked up, right? Like the two dads always get in a fight and everything falls apart.
Right, it's so perfect. It's like the community's happening, but these two ideologues are just still fucking fighting it out to figure out which reigns supreme.
Right, and this totally works here too, where I do think that it's a valid thing to depict because we are all existing in these spaces where it's really just an argument happening to different generations of white dudes that are like, oh no, it's their fault. No, it's those ones' fault. Them and their, you know, avocado toast. And it's like, no, them and their, you know, Reagan. And it's like, God, can we all just agree that you guys fucked it all up and now we're trying to fix it, you know? And that's what I feel like what's happening with Charles and Logan is they're both trying to reconcile that both of their approaches not only didn't work, but they made things worse. And so the lessons they both learn is just to get back to the basics of like, just keep these kids alive. That's all you've got to do. Just keep them alive. Yeah, yeah. They'll make it better once they survive adolescence and, you know, mutanthood in this aggressive and inhospitable world. Just have to keep them alive.
There's, I think, such a theme in action movies and such a necessary theme of don't let the past keep you from doing what you can in the present and the future. Mm-hmm. But we need more practical advice on like, how do you not let it?
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's, I think, what these conversations in media should be about, of like also understanding that the issues of the past that are holding you back exist right now. Mm-hmm. And they're holding you back because you're not addressing them right now and today. Like, these problems existed before. And that's why, like, the recurring theme of how do we humanize soldiers after the war? Mm. And how do we teach them to be human beings again? And how do we not turn them into soldiers again? Which I think is definitely being approached in this story. And the idea that violence is something that you can't escape from and that it definitely taints you, but you don't have to be the thing that it tries to shape you into.
Right. And interestingly, like, the issue between Charles and Logan is that his disappointment with Logan is that he's singularly minded and still just like kind of inside. It's not even like my legacy was to be like the best killing machine or whatever. He's like, my legacy was like just to maybe like be kind and be helpful. And I'm disappointed that you're just still so in your own shit that you can't do that. And it's a funny inversion of like what the actual, it's like still rooted in the same thing, which is like, I want you to do my thing. And I'm sad that you're not doing my thing, but it's a funny inversion about like what the my thing is.
Well, and I see that conversation as much Charles talking to himself as Logan.
Sure.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like this great legacy that he thought he was going to leave behind. And he's an old man in a bed who doesn't know who he is half the time. And the one person that he has a connection to in the outside world is essentially a violent version of the Fonz. And he just won't grow up. And like Charles' whole thing was teaching children how to grow up and to be good people. And he's stuck with this eternal angsty teenager who is miring in his own shit. But at the same time, he's also reflecting on the fact that he himself didn't help. Like all the things that he wanted to do and wanted to be didn't happen. And that he's disappointed in himself.
Right. I do want to ask a question of you, Sarah, before we ask the last question is, how did this movie hit you as a person who doesn't care necessarily, who doesn't have an emotional attachment or connection to the lore and the characters?
I have kind of an attachment. I'm just in a very low percentile. I mean, I think what's so great about fandom is that it creates a context for stories. And I feel that as I work on my Sex and the City play. And when I share it with people, it's like we instantly understand. It's like it's not like you've created this character, a new character that people have to get to know. And then they're going to do this stuff. It's like Samantha Jones is anything. Samantha Jones is eating an orange and you're like, I'm there, you know. And I think that to me, this movie is a great example of, you know, I was fully invested in it because I didn't feel like I was missing the importance of what was happening in front of me, because within the context of the movie on the screen, I knew where I was and what was going on and why it mattered. And also understood just by being a part of the culture in a general way, who these characters are. But it created kind of a hanger for a story that really was allowed to be fairly simple. I think because of all the background lore, and there's so much power in simplicity. And so I could just enjoy it as a great American road trip claw movie.
That's great. We know that this movie is littered with fathers.
And their corpses.
And that's the recommendation. You want to see a movie that's littered with fathers and their corpses? Who, Gene, in your view, is the daddy of Logan?
I have to go with Charles. As much as this this movie feels, you know, and rightly so, like a redemption arc for Logan, it is as much a redemption arc for Charles. You know, like I said, like just learning that, you know, you don't have to have these lofty ideas of legacy, that your legacy can be that you saved one kid.
Yeah.
Oh, and I was going to mention two things because this is, you know, detail oriented. I was going to say I really liked the fact that the whole thing about the place they were going to eat in, that it was a latitude location that was in the comic book, and that that's why he didn't think it was real. And then it turned out to be real. And that you don't need to decide whether the kids took it from the comic book and made that destination or whatever. That the idea that if he had just listened to her and believed her, you know, because she was right. And it didn't matter if he didn't understand why it was right.
Right, which Charles tells him about 45 times in succession at some point. And he's just like, it does not matter. It matters to her. And he's like, she's not a human. She's my daughter.
It's a great lesson of fatherhood.
Right. And and the genetic modified corn syrup thing and how that was supposed to get rid of the mutants. This rewatch, that really struck me as that's a silent genocide.
Yeah.
It's like Alexander Graham Bell with the deaf and hard of hearing.
Wow.
Right? And that even in this film, it's continuing the exploration of that dynamic that existed in the comic books and the other movies of people who are considered either a threat or inferior are eliminated and the rest of the world just goes, whatever happened to them?
Right.
And never stop to think of, like, something had to have been done to them for them to disappear.
Oh, that's fascinating. That makes me care more about that. I do wish that we didn't get it in the last like 15 minutes in an evil guy exposition, but I do like that.
Yeah. Well, they ran out of time.
Right. Well, and like, I don't know if that was the intent behind that, you know?
But even if they don't know it, it's there, you know, that's what's so great about cultural criticism is that, you know, these texts, the author doesn't have to understand what they're saying to be expressing the waters we're all trying to navigate.
Yes.
Right. Because we're all floating in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just said a thing I've been trying to figure out how to say for a very long time. And I'm glad that you said it that way.
Right. Like, because when I try to talk about like how I think great filmmakers or, you know, just male filmmakers who have made like some great feminine characters, like, you know, Ellen Ripley and Sarah Connor, I always think about the idea, it's, you know, metaphor because I'm a visual thinker, is that creators can be putting together puzzle pieces in the dark. And so they may not know what the picture they're constructing looks like. They can still feel the edges and know it fits right. So they, you know, they're not necessarily sure what they're actually creating for other people to see, but they're still feeling what's there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I love that.
Well, I'm going to say, and I feel terribly that I don't know the name of this person, but they don't get a ton of screen time. So I'll blame it on that. I'm going to say the Oklahoma farming mom is the daddy in this case for being like, we should probably just cut our losses and go have a better life. Which is absolutely a thing that everyone needs to hear. Like, that's what everybody needs to hear in this movie is like, we should not hold on to thinking that this torturous thing that we have devoted ourselves to is the entirety of reality. There are other situations, and that is what everyone is confronting in one way or another. And she has an extremely lovely, sad, because she ultimately dies, but like a heroic confrontation that we see hinted at, but sort of shown off screen, where she's clearly trying to take care of her family. She ultimately saves her husband temporarily as a result. And she says the thing everyone needs to hear, which I appreciate.
Yeah.
Sarah Marshall.
My daddy is YouTube commenter Davery Killing 2970, who wrote simply, "Bring your daughter to work day."
Right. Well said.
Jean the fangirl, how can people find you?
You can find me anywhere under Fangirl Jean, and that's J-E-A-N-N-E. You know, I'm still in the places, but I mostly am doom scrolling on TikTok and disassociating. But So I am doing like more videos on TikTok of the nature that I used to do in threads on Twitter, basically talking about, you know, how colonialism is to blame for all of the horror tropes and how Paul is not the hero in Dune. And all those things.
Nice. My favorite Dune adaptation, which Alex, I've shown to you, is like a Minneapolis St. Paul improv troupe, I think, did like a suited version of Dune that was 7 minutes long. And so my favorite is their Paul's wearing a garbage bag as a still suit, standing in someone's basement looking at like a Costco case of Dasani, saying, "Millions of deciliters of water." That's the best Dune adaptation.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Beautiful. All right, everybody, that's it for this week's episode of You Are Good at Feelings podcast about movies. Thank you so much to Fangirl Jean for joining us. Thank you to Miranda Zickler for producing and editing this episode. Thanks to our founding and supervising producer, Carolyn Kendrick, for being you. Thank you for listening to the episode. Thanks to Fresh Lesh for providing the beats that make our episode sound so sweet. Thanks to Alyssa Onofria for making videos that we can share on social media that come out of each of these episodes. We just had one do real numbers on Reels and TikTok about art. It was about art direction from our Bones and All episode. People really liked what Sarah had to say about what constitutes as good art direction in 80s media in particular. Thanks for finding us on social media at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod. Thanks for letting your friends know you like this show so that more people can listen. Let's bring more people into the fold. Let's get more ears on the You Are Good train. Thanks to y'all for supporting us on Patreon and Apple Podcast subscriptions, where you get those bonus episodes, which you like so much. Thanks to Fresh Lesh for providing the beats that make our episodes sound so sweet. And truly, thank you so, so much for being here. We appreciate you. And don't forget that you, my friend, you are good.